fashion drop by from Zero Shoes. Now, you probably saw him on Shark Tank, and if you haven't, you've probably seen him in stores across the country with this whole barefoot movement, and he's getting so much traction that we thought we would invite him to come down and share with us his story and some of his great knowledge and wisdom. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Knowledge and wisdom, that's a lot of pressure.
Woo! I'm putting a lot of pressure on the front end.
Well, my pleasure.
Good. I'm glad you're here. Let's start with your story. Tell us and kind of the people who'll be watching this a little bit about how you got to where you are today.
Oh my God. Well, at 52 years old, that's a long story. So how little of that do you want me to, how much do you want me to compress? Here, I'll do the short version.
Yeah.
I've never had a job. So
that's
not totally
true.
The only job I had, they gave me total free rein to do whatever I wanted. I was performing at Busch Gardens in Williamsburg, doing magic and comedy things. But other than that, I've never had a job. So everything I've ever done has been me inventing something or me going out and selling, me doing something. I was a professional stand-up comic for a number of years. And so everything, in a certain way, what we're doing now at Zero Shoes is the culmination of all of those bits and pieces. They literally did really come together in a rather surprising way that has allowed both my wife and I to kind of max out our experience and our personalities into this business. So that's the big picture overview of how we got here.
Let me ask you a question on that, because you said something kind of, well, a lot of interesting things, but it's kind of a circuitous route.
Yeah,
right. And I have the same thing. I mean, well, my job's only lasted 18 months. So why anybody ever hired me is beyond me. Because if you looked at my resume, I jumped ship every 18 months.
Funny.
But what I heard you say was that you took all your experience and brought it together.
Well, and it's not that it was deliberate. Way this business happened was completely accidental. 6 years ago, I started sprinting as a 45-year-old guy. I don't necessarily advise that. I was just getting injured constantly. And a friend of mine who's a world-class runner said, take off your shoes and see what that does. And when I started running barefoot, I very quickly discovered the problems that I had in my form that were causing my injuries, and they very quickly self-corrected, and my injuries went away, and I wanted to be more barefoot more of the time. So I knew about this whole idea of making minimalist sandals, like the Tarahumara in India and in Mexico. They wear sandals made just out of scraps of tire strapped to their feet, and I knew about that. So I did my version of that and started people around me like them. Actually, that's a newer version. The first thing we did was just a sheet of rubber, some rope, strap, you know, cut it out, strap it to your foot. Very DIY. And I bought enough material to make shoes for myself, for Lena, my wife, and about five other people. And then about 10 more people said, hey, we want some. So I took the money that I made, which was like $50 from the first batch, put that into inventory and bought, you know, made the next batch, and another, then 20 people wanted them. And I took the money that I made from the second batch and put it into the third batch. And then someone said, you know, if you treated this like a business, if you had a website, I'd put you in this book that I'm writing about barefoot running. And I went, oh, and I pitched the idea to my wife, and she told me I was a moron. And I said, yeah, you're right. And this is a stupid idea. And when she went to bed, I built a website. So,
yes, dear, you go to sleep now.
Exactly. Luckily, she goes to bed earlier than I do.
That's funny.
But it was just, you know, it was in my head. I had to get it out of my head. And then literally the next thing we knew, because it launched about 2 weeks after I built the site, I had to put a couple of pieces together. And this is in November, the end of November, selling sandals in Colorado on a website. But by the middle of January, we knew this is our full-time job. And it really was just accidental, coincidental, serendipitous, wonderful, that it really did combine all of our respective skills and talents and interests. In fact, more so, prior to that, Lena and I had basically been retired. So we didn't really know each other as working people. And it turns out that, I mean, the highlight of my life is working with my wife, because we're a really, really great team. And people say, oh, starting a business, it ruins relationships. It's made us so much closer. And we went from having, you know, the occasional husband and wife tiff every year to now every 6 months, but they only last about 2 hours. And so it's like, that's easy. So, and it's always the same thing. It's like, I know we're both stressed out. We need a nap. And we're done.
Right.
But really, what I love about what we're doing is how accidental it was and how many completely unpredictable, unreproducible things have allowed us to get where we are, meeting people almost randomly who've been hugely important in our business. I mean, one of our employees just walked in. This is a guy named Dennis Driscoll. He's got over 36 years in the footwear business. He was the co-founder of Avia Footwear. He was the former head of global product design for Crocs. The reason he's here this is great. So Lane and I had been seeing this body worker who one day was walking his dog. He normally doesn't walk his dog. Meanwhile, Dennis, who normally doesn't walk his dog, is walking his dog. Normally it's the two wives who walk the dogs.
Right.
The two dogs knew each other. They met. So Dennis and our other friend, Gary, they met. Gary starts talking, Dennis starts talking, and then eventually Gary says, you know, you should talk to my friend Steven. He calls me and says, you should talk to this guy Dennis. We got together, and, you know, now we're working with this incredibly talented guy. What are the odds? So, you know, that's been a huge part. And what's interesting to me, this is my last thought about it, is if you talk to most business people and ask them how much was fate and chance and serendipity and wacky, unpredictable things, how much is that a part of your success? You get a much more interesting answer than when you ask them, so how are you successful?
Yeah.
And then they tell you this story about what they did.
Well, it makes me wonder, and I'm a kind of big believer of this, that if you keep your eyes open, there's actually a lot of opportunity and serendipitous moments, whatever we want to call them,
sure,
coincidence, whatever, around us, just most of us aren't actually paying attention to take advantage of them.
I think it's that. I think it's a combination of exactly that. Like there's this whole idea about focus and attention and blah blah blah. But it really is like once you buy a red car, you suddenly start seeing a lot of red cars. It's a similar thing. If you really start looking and you put yourself in the way of situations where you might bump into someone, you know, never pass up an opportunity to say what you're doing or to go somewhere where you could meet some random new person. Plus the crazy, weird, random things that, you know, no matter what you do, it has nothing to do with you. It just seemed to have happened.
That's awesome. I'm a big believer in the, you know, if you pay attention to what's going on around you, there's actually a lot of signs from whether you call it the universe or spirit, whatever your thing is, you know, I think that there's like little things buzzing around that you can take advantage of.
My line is there's lots of signs, but don't forget you're the one who's the sign painter.
Right. Excellent point.
Thank you.
I will take that. So now that you've been in business for a while, I mean, how does it feel? What are you guys up to? You know, you went from, well, actually, let me back up and say that, you know, I think a lot of the best ideas come by accident, by a moment in your own life where, you know, you had pain or injury. I was shopping online at 2:00 in the morning and really frustrated about something. I mean, that's kind of why I think some of the best ideas happen, or I should say.
I think, you know, the crux of invention seems to be, okay, I'm frustrated about something. Yeah. Now here's a way to get unfrustrated. The magic question is, did you identify a frustration that other people are experiencing as well, enough other people are experiencing, and is your solution good enough and appropriate at the right time? But definitely, I would agree, a huge motivator for invention is that feeling of...
Yeah, I always tell people to follow the frustration, because if we actually stopped and tried to solve it, we may actually have a great idea. How did you decide that your idea had enough other people that had that frustration? What kind of milestones did you look for?
We didn't decide. It was just thrown in our face. I mean, literally, you know, the because you can start an online business so quickly and easily, and I've done a lot of that. So that was the combination of luck and chance meeting our history. You know, I'm the kind of person who, when someone says, hey, if you had a website and I can have one up in 2 hours, that's, someone said, how long did it take you to build your website? I said 15 years, because I'd been doing it for a long time. But for us, it really was just the response we got was telling us, not that we were looking for some specific milestone. It's like once we started out literally in a corner of a spare bedroom in our house, and then we bought a table. And then we bought two more tables. And then we took over that room plus the living room. Then we took over that room plus the living room plus the dining room plus the garage. It's like it was the demand made it clear. So as our time was required, there was never any real conversation about it. It was just like, oh gosh, we got another 40 orders.
Right.
We got to
get out the door. You kind of hit something really big.
What happened was, in late 2009, there's a book called Born to Run, and the whole
I read it and loved it, and it changed how I run.
It's an amazing book, even if you're not a runner.
Yeah.
But, you know, the whole barefoot movement was taking off just at the time that we were. So we really caught the wave, and completely accidental. But so it was just, again, that confluence of factors that made it happen.
Yeah. I love that book. That changed me to barefoot running, and all my knee pain went away. So it's I'm a firm believer in kind of what, not just the interesting story that you have, but kind of what you guys do as well, because I've seen the difference in a lot of people.
Are we, and just as a quick aside, the full effects of actually using your body rather than wrapping it up in big, thick shoes that didn't exist 40 years ago has only been barely, the surface has barely been scraped. There's a lot of repercussions about using your, look, a quarter of the bones in your body are in your feet, more nerve endings there than anywhere but your fingers and your mouth, and that's not an accident. So if you don't use those things, you lose a lot of function, both physical, you lose the support for your whole body, and some research shows that it reduces cognitive function as well. So there's a lot more research going on, and we want to be part of making people aware of what the value is of
What I'm really interested in isn't just kind of metrics and milestones, although I think those things are important. What I find really fascinating and valuable is the mindset that goes behind it as well. I think that as we launch into the entrepreneurial world, there are beliefs and behaviors and attitudes that really drive how we operate and how kind of what it takes to live in this world, because it's, there is no steady paycheck. There aren't kind of some of the things of security that you might get in a... I like how you said it, too, by the way. You elongated. It was like,
Someone asked me the other day, a whole bunch of Shark Tank people. Actually, it was a Shark Tank alum who was invited to do a presentation about entrepreneurialism at a high school. He says, what's the best piece of advice that you would give these budding entrepreneurs? And I wrote, get a government job with a pension.
Opposite.
I was not kidding.
Well, and I don't think it's for everyone. So I'm curious, when you look at yourself and the other ones around you, kind of what you think is some of the things that allow you to play in the space, because it's easy and hard all at the same time.
The hard part, people say to Elaine and I, hey, you have your own business. That must be so much fun. We go, you've never done this before, have you?
Are you in your PJs right now?
Yeah. I don't know, to be honest. I know there's been some research that shows the only thing that many entrepreneurs have in common is having at least one parent that was an entrepreneur. And my father was self-employed. He was a doctor. My mother was always starting or being involved in startup businesses. So that was kind of where I grew up. It never occurred to me. It's not true. I just remember a situation, and maybe this answered your question.
Yes.
So when I was a kid, when I was about 15, maybe, I was a street performer. And when I was 18 or 19 or both, I went to New York City for the summer to perform there. I grew up outside of D.C. And so I started in D.C., moved to New York, was street performing. One day, I got on the number 6 train downtown in New York.
Mm-hmm. I know it. I used to live there.
Up the Upper East Side. So this is the train that goes from Wall Street up to the Upper East Side, where all the boring rich people lived.
Yep.
And I was the only one on the entire train who wasn't wearing an identical suit. And I remember having this thought, I will never do that. And interestingly, so I get to college and had this kind of convoluted path, and I ended up thinking that I was going to go into business and marketing. And all the people that I knew and all the people that were pitching us as soon-to-be graduates were pitching us corporate jobs. And I just went,
no.
Can't do it. Cannot do it. Especially because they had all these internship programs to do things that I'd already been doing. I'd already been writing copy. I'd already been doing sales. I'd already been developing products. It's like, why do I need to go to an internship? So
I wonder if it's something about how you prefer to learn, too. I mean, I'm the same. So I have an undergraduate degree, but I didn't get my MBA. And people always say to me, well, how did you learn finance and marketing and sales? I'm like, well,
figured out
I had to do it because I had to run a business.
Yeah, so, you figured out on the fly.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the street of hard, school of hard knocks, but it's nice.
Well, it's interesting. It's like, I remember taking, I was a psychology major, and I remember taking statistics.
Oh,
and,
so was I.
And I'm, I will say this unabashedly. I think of myself as a relatively smart guy. Taking statistics, I remember thinking, literally, like, I'm a smart guy. Why can't I figure this out? But then a year and a half later, I was actually doing research. And when I got my data and I had to figure out if it meant anything, then statistics was fascinating.
Yeah.
So the application, learning via application, I think is the only way you can do it anyway, no matter what happens in the classroom. That's where the rubber meets the road, pun intended.
Right. Well, there's definitely something about you take what you learn and you apply it. And that's really where the learning happens.
You know, Lena, when we, for the first couple of years, probably actually, we've been doing this now 4 years, up until about yesterday. One of the complaints that Lena has had is that she has said that she doesn't feel like she knows what she's doing on a daily basis. I went, none of us do.
Yeah.
And, you just had the idea that you're supposed to know in advance. And she went, oh. And so now, I mean, we walk in every day, and maybe this is the answer. Yeah. It's a willingness, and you can't make yourself have it, but it's a willingness to walk in on a daily basis and go, okay, let's find out how stupid I am today and figure it out, because you've got no choice.
I love the way you said that, because I do think you're right. I think to be an entrepreneur, and, you know, that word gets thrown around a lot. So it's, you know, entrepreneur, entrepreneurship, and now they've got all these kind of programs with it. But I think to carve your own path, whatever that path looks like, is a matter of walking in and saying, I'm willing to accept whatever comes my way, and I'll just figure it out. And I will make the best decision in the moment.
And then see what it does and cross my fingers and fix it if it changes. You know, people ask me, they say things like, well, what are you going to do if the following happens? I go, I don't know. I got to wait till I get there.
Yeah.
And so that kind of improvisational nature of things is a big part of it. There's another part that I think is really important and often overlooked, which is it's related to a question you asked before. It's the feedback part. It's the what's the world telling you. I see so many people who get committed to their idea and the way they want to live their life, that they entrepreneur themselves into bankruptcy, or worse. And it's usually something where, look, no one can predict the future. No one can say, hey, that's a brilliant idea, or hey, that's a crappy idea, except for the crappy idea. There are some times where it's so screamingly not a good idea, and then you can get feedback that people aren't interested in it, and, you know, the willingness to cut bait and say, yeah, that one didn't work.
Yeah.
I think that's an important part too. And it's hard for humans.
Well,
I mean, literally.
It's the don't call my baby ugly problem.
Don't call my baby ugly, but it's more than that. It's literally parts of our brain that do not respond well to loss. So we tend to, when things are going really well, we tend to want to stop it just in case. And when things are going really bad, we go, no, I want to turn it around. We're wired upside down for risk. And so there's a certain part of entrepreneurialism where if you don't turn that right side up for business, you're at least willing to have it turned upside down or right side up for you when you get beaten up enough by reality.
That's a really interesting point. I don't know that I've ever heard it articulated that way, and I want to kind of delve a little bit further into it, because there's a middle level, for lack of a better way to say it, where I find that the idea that I started in my head and then what I put out into the world a year later looks nothing the way I started. So there's this tweaking element that you have to be open to. You know, to your point about, I've seen people drive themselves into the ground because they refuse to change and tweak and evolve their idea, as well as kind of not let it go, but they're just refusing to move. I mean, you said this wasn't your first design, right? I mean, that's never the first one.
Correct. So, well, and we're still making improvements, and we're still making changes, and we're always... Now, the trick there is... And there's no prescription for this, but sometimes you need to change and evolve, and sometimes that's the thing that people want, and your better idea is not.
Yeah.
And so you have to be, I think you need to be open to both. And it's a conversation that we have on a regular basis. Like, okay, we're doing this thing, and we're getting this response. Does it mean that we are moving into a different market? Does it mean that we need to go back to our roots? Does it mean that we need to change the message? Do we need to? So it's a real conversation about the product. So it's not just, look, no one's made any real changes in the wire coat hanger for a while, and that thing makes money. So for a very small number of people who built the machines in the 1900s.
Right, if only.
But, yeah. I mean, I got to be honest. When I heard about the wire coat hanger business, it was the most painful thing to realize that it's impossible to get into because they don't make the equipment anymore, and it would be too expensive to make the equipment to then get to break even. But it's one of these weird little businesses where, you know, the one factory I read about, they run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with 8 people total, and do something like $1 billion a year. And it's just, you know, the barrier to entry is
so high.
Yeah, it's impossible. But suffice it to say, if they tried to figure out some different way of doing the wire coat hanger, it would kill their business.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there's certain products that you need to be continually looking for the next thing. And I think there's for every different product, there's a balance between those two energies.
Do you think that there's and maybe there isn't, a key to knowing whether it's kind of just innovation for innovation's sake, or if it's actually something that is going to make a difference? Or is that just a matter of trial and error too?
I think probably more trial and error than anything else. It's kind of like, it's mostly going to be trial and error. The only, like for us, for example, the new product, there's a number of things about it that are very different than our old product. And some of the people who are diehard, really ultra barefoot people, they just want the old product. They don't want this. That's okay. Because we're expanding the market and going to more and more people who aren't about barefoot, who aren't about running, who just like the most comfortable, versatile, healthy sandal they can get their feet on. And that's what we're developing. Mm-hmm. So to a certain extent, we have to be careful. It's like if someone says, well, I wanted the old one, do we pay attention to them, or do we look and see what the market is telling us?
Right.
And so it's similarly, it's just this constant feedback loop where you need to be very responsive and receptive to the information, mm-hmm. And not attached to your position unnecessarily, but not willing to throw it away
right.
too soon. It's again, there's no, you're going to find lots and lots of books that will give you an answer to this question, and they are lying. There is no answer to this question. So there's just the question, yeah. and then your response, and then monitoring that and being able to adapt yeah. to that and crossing your fingers that you're the one that, you know, gets it right.
Yeah, well, in a weird way, and nobody likes it when I say this because there's no, to your point, there's no answer to it, but it's your internal compass and filter that says that's the feedback I'm going to take in and that's not the feedback
yeah.
I'm going to take in.
People, we've sort of moved to this a little bit. The thing that in a way disturbs me most about the whole conversation about entrepreneurialism
yeah.
is something you said earlier in a way, which is you can't make someone turn someone into an entrepreneur. You're either wanting to
yeah.
do it that way, or wired to do it that way, or forced to do it that way. It's going to be a compulsion of some sort. Similarly, there's no formula for getting it right, and there's a multi-billion-dollar industry in selling stuff, selling formulas, but they're all stories about the past that are unreproducible, and
yeah.
it pains me to no end when people waste their money on what someone promises them is an answer. Yeah, and there is
yeah.
not an answer.
Yeah.
And good.
Well, you know, I couldn't agree more, and that's why I struggle with universities that have entrepreneurship programs, because
yeah.
if they're based in text, I'm not really sure how relevant it really is. But, and not that you can't learn skills, but just overall, I have
right.
my own personal issue with it. But the other part of that is, you said it about books. It's so interesting. And this is why I love to do interviews and gather stories, because I can take a nugget from everybody's story and say, that's something I should think about and how I build my story.
Mm.
But I think that there's a million ways to do it in any business that you're in. And actually, the crash of 2008, as horrible as it was for a lot of people, opened up this path, because suddenly the rules kind of fell away and suddenly we're kind of allowed to do it our way. But I'm a big believer in stalking people who I think are doing innovative things, not reading their books, because by the time their books
oh, yeah.
come out,
it's over.
It's
They're
5 years
on something else.
Right, right. It takes them a year to do it, so I'm not going to do that. So I'm stalking you, Stephen. Now you know.
Oh, well, that's awfully sweet. I was wondering who that was outside last night. One of my favorite things about that is in the late 90s, there was a guy, I wish I could remember his name, wrote a bunch of books, or at least one, that was well known about finding a balance between your work life and your life.
Mm.
And then sold a ton of books, had workshops, had all the stuff. And then in the early 2000s, had a book that was basically called "Sorry, I Had My Head Up My Ass." And you know, it was a fantasy that a whole lot of people had. The reality is that sometimes work demands all your time, and sometimes you can go back and have life. And sometimes that's the reality of it. And this book was a formula. Sold a ton. It was a formula for a fantasy that people wanted. Sold a ton. This book that was about reality.
Tanked.
Nothing. Nothing.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of books out there. Like I said, I like to gain a nugget from everybody and, kind of carve it into whatever works for me. And I love that you're saying that. So hopefully people watching this will realize that this is your story. And hopefully they can learn a little something from your story, but they've got to create whatever their story is.
If any, people say, what kind of beliefs do you need to be an entrepreneur? I go, there's only one, which is, man, good work.
Yeah.
and that's about it. It's like some curiosity, and then the rest of it is figuring out on the fly. If anybody... Oh, gosh. I was going to say, if anyone finds anything about our life inspirational, and then I couldn't think of an end to the sentence, I think it's delusional. You can't model in the same way that no one's able to set a good New Year's resolution and stick to it. You're not going to be able to model yourself on someone else's story or someone else's personality unless you're their identical twin, and even then it's a little iffy.
Right.
So ironically, even the thing of just be yourself is a silly formula, because who else are you going to be?
Right.
So
this is what we got.
Yeah. Do something, cross your fingers, have fun. Eventually we're all dead.
So motivational. It's been a pleasure.
I find that actually very liberating.
Yeah. You know what? You're actually right. As you say that, I'm thinking, well, this is the only March 10th, 2014 I got. So I might as well have a great time and, do what I love and work hard, because there is a lot of hard work when it comes to being an entrepreneur, People always ask me, do I get to work in my PJs all day? Not really know. It's not actually
Well, wait, I got to tell you a story about that. So one of my previous companies, I had a software company, and I was living in a two-bedroom apartment. One of the bedrooms was the company.
Yeah.
And I eventually hired a sales and marketing guy. And at one point, he says, you know, we need an office. I went, no, we don't. We're running this fine out of here. He says, no, we need an office because I'm sick of coming to work and having you in your underwear all day.
Well, you know, my dirty secret, I love hot yoga, so I'm always in athleisure wear. Like, no matter where you find me, I'm just constantly in yoga clothes in the hopes that, you know, if I can get done with that call, I can go to yoga. That's how I live my day. When can I get to yoga?
Yeah.
But it is a lot of hard work. I mean, I, you know, it's one of those things where they say, well, do you work, you know, 30 hours a week? I said, well, some weeks.
I was going to say some days.
Yeah, right, some days, right. And other weeks, I'm 90, 100. You know, it just kind of depends on the demands of what's going on. But, you know, I guess the – I don't know how you feel about this, but I love it so much that even when I go on vacation, I don't have this deep need to shut it all down because I don't – I love my life. Like, I don't really – I like to rejuvenate and I like to, like, you know, put it away. But I'm not – I don't have that feeling of I got to get away from my work.
I do.
Yeah.
And in fact, Lena and I do it every evening. We come home, we eat dinner, we watch TV for a couple hours. But more than that, how do I want to put it? This is a very hard gig that is our retirement fund.
Yeah.
This is, we got nothing else. We're all in on this.
This is plan A, B, and C.
Yeah, this is it. So, I love the idea of getting away from it. I love the idea of being done in some way. I almost love more the fantasy that all I would be responsible for is the parts that I really, really enjoy, but we're not in that phase yet. And we're talking to strategic partners. We're doing a big fundraise right now. That could happen. Or it could be that I just have more stuff on
right
my
to
list.
Do. To do,
my
to-do
list.
To do.
So I don't know. But for the fun of saying it, we were essentially retired from 2000 to 2009. And I did a lot of things, but there was nothing that I had to do and nothing that I had to do for revenue. And that was a really important part of my life and was great. And it was fun. People would call and say, hey, would you like to make an extra $10,000 this month? I go, nope. Don't care. Or as I said to a friend of mine, the gap between doing a little every day and doing nothing every day is huge. It's infinite. And I like doing that. I've never had my personal identity tied in with the thing that I'm doing. So now that said, I'm always trying to figure out how things work and do that. So even when I was not working, there was a lot of things that I did that were a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But I think the word enough is highly understood, highly underappreciated. And when we were retired, it wasn't on a boatload of cash. It was in a moment where we realized some investments that we had made, some businesses that we had done some work with, were throwing off enough money that it would pay all of our living expenses. And it's like, so do we spend a bunch of time working to have a bigger house, or are we done?
No.
And that conversation took about 5 seconds. And I have a friend who started and sold two companies, made a lot of money. And I said, what was the most interesting thing once you realized you were off the financial grid? And he said, I spent the first 2 years where I wouldn't get out of bed until it was totally clear in my mind that I never needed to do anything ever.
Wow.
And then I'd get out of bed. And that lasted for about 2 years till suddenly I just knew that that was the case. And he has a really fine life, only doing things that he completely enjoys because he doesn't need to do anything else. And he was in the shoe business, when I told him about what I was doing, I said, I hope you don't think I'm asking you for money. He goes, don't you remember? If you were in the business of printing money, I would not invest in your company. And and I think people fantasize about what it would be like to have more than enough and don't know what enough means. And when you know what enough means, it's hard. It's tricky. I mean, we don't have children, and that's a tricky thing too, to kind of not be part of the everyone has children game. It's really hard to be part of the this is enough, and it's not more. It's not huge, but it allows me to have a kind of to explore a level of contentedness that you can't get in any other way. And anyway, that's my philosophical diatribe.
No, that's great. Was that a conscious decision of that kind of number and that lifestyle, or was that something that you realized in a moment, wait a minute, this is enough?
It was a little bit of both. I had been thinking about this idea since I was in my early 20s. There's a classic book called Your Money or Your Life, and the basic premise is that once you know what your expenses are, start taking some amount of money and invest it in something ridiculously safe until the interest from that is providing more money than what it takes to live on. And then some interesting things happen. It's not a smooth curve, but regardless, it's something I had been thinking about a lot since I was probably younger than 20. And then, like you said, an opportunity arose. We're in a room full of people, and there's a guy who made some comment about doing some sort of real estate investing. And out of this room of 50 people who ostensibly were all there to learn about strategies for becoming financially independent, Lena and I were the only two who walked up to this guy and said, "Sir, are you taking partners?" And so we approached this guy. That created a situation that, in part, allowed us to recognize, like, oh my God, this just happened. We didn't even realize it. I mean, I owned a condo that we sold at the top of the market because we just saw the market changing. And it was just, a confluence of factors that allowed it to happen in a very different way. So it was something we'd been putting our attention towards, but then some things just happened. And literally it was like, we could take the money from the condo, buy a house, and still have to pay $2,000 a month.
Right.
Or we're done. And it's like, I think we're done.
Done sounds better, actually.
Done sounds really good.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because I do think enough is a hard thing for entrepreneurs in particular to struggle with, because you're always trying to get to the next level, whatever that level is. And well, I struggle with it for sure.
Pardon me for interrupting. There's another thing that competes with enough, which is if you had some success in the past, you're going to assume, and again, this is just the way our brains are wired, you're going to assume that it was because of you. You'll forget all those magical, crazy, wacky things that happened. You're going to assume that it's because of you. And if you get another idea, it's going to feel just like that first one.
Right.
It's going to be exciting. It's going to be new. It's going to be all those things. And you're going to assume that because you did it the last time, you're going to be able to do it again. It cracks me up. I'm going out raising money right now. And part of the pitch is, look, we did it before. We'll be able to do it again. Completely not true. And everyone in the investment community knows it. But when you say you've done it before, they go, oh, well, then you must be able to do it again.
It's a check mark of validity. Like, check, done it.
Right. It's crazy. Yeah. So even if you failed before, the fact that you did it and failed is almost good enough. Right. So there's this weird thing that we do where we assume that what caused our success in the past is us, and therefore we haven't changed, we can recreate in the future. And I've seen so many entrepreneurs take huge, huge windfalls and where they had enough and turn it into, oh crap, I need to go be a greeter at Walmart because they thought they were smart again.
Right.
And so
and they weren't.
No, they were lucky the first time.
Yeah.
Or maybe they were smart the first time, but not the second time. So it's that desire to do it again and to prove yourself again, and because this feels just like that last one, it must be just as good, that often gets in the way of that investigation of, is this enough and what would I do if it were?
Let me ask you a question on that, because it's such a powerful reminder that, you know, when you're up, you were down. When you're down, you were up. Kind of got to remember all those different things. But you said in there, you also said that, you know, it was kind of the people around you. It wasn't necessarily just you that helped you get to that level of success, and now you're starting a new idea, and you have whole different people around you.
Even if you have the exact same team, you know. Just as a quick story, so I invented this particular internet marketing strategy. I won't get into the details; it's not important. I was one of the early guys on the internet, and I figured out a way of doing things on the internet in a particular industry that no one had done before online. And we implemented it online, and it just worked like gangbusters. And then we did it again in a different business, and it worked like gangbusters. And by the third time, other people had figured it out, and it worked like nothing. And
the ingredients in the recipe change.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, you can't step in the same river twice. So it's, it's just, there's not a formula.
Yeah, that's so great. So I know we're kind of wrapping up our time, and I want to be respectful, not keep you over, but is there any, you know, piece of advice or just kind of lesson or story? I love stories. So lesson or story that you've had along the way that was one of those moments that makes you say, yeah, this is kind of part of, a big part of why I'm here. I mean, it all kind of wraps together, as you said, but.
People ask me questions like that, or they say, who do you admire or your heroes? And I often don't have answers for either of those, because I don't try to – I don't find myself comparing myself to anyone else just because they're different people. And whatever I know of them is only a portion of it anyway.
Yeah.
So I don't want to say that I admire some guy who turns out to be a whatever.
Yeah.
When you get to know them, I can admire things about people, yeah. aspects of them, but I don't know those people. So, similarly, I can't. Hold on, I'm on the verge of one. Yeah, it's not a specific thing, but it's a thing.
Yeah.
This is 2014. Is that right?
I hope so. That's what I've been putting on my checks.
It's my favorite. Bill Maher. So again, I used to be a comic. Bill Maher used to do a joke. It's my favorite joke. He says, "Do you think in the year one people are walking around going, oh, it's April and I'm still running zero on my checks?" Love that joke. About 14, 15 years ago, I just started questioning almost everything. I just started developing a particular sensitivity to when someone said something with a certain kind of conviction, for looking underneath the idea to see if it was true, to see what other things might cause that same effect.
Right.
Could there be other other things that would lead to? I can't find the word I'm looking for. Were things put together the way people say? And so, like in the business world, again, it's, you know, pick a business book that looks at some number of companies historically and tells you that's the way to do it. It's like, okay, well, how many other companies did those exact same things at that exact same time that failed?
Right.
And that particular company that you just featured a week after you wrote the book went into bankruptcy.
Right.
Or, you know, so I just started really listening to the way people talked about things that they were confident about and started developing this question about, all right, so what's really making that tick? Now, again, this is what makes things tick is just a part of my personality. That's always been an interest of mine. But when it came to business in particular and psychological things in particular and in my relationship, I started really just wondering. And that made a big, big change because I stopped it really put an end to trying to fit myself into some shape that isn't the way this thing is shaped.
Right.
And because once you can find that for every story of how it was done, for example, there's infinite number of stories that argue that one.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what that story is. That this is the hero thing. It's like, I don't care how someone else did it. You know, our joke is, I'm very Steve Jobs-esque without the cash. if I had the money, you know, people would just allow me to be a little more obnoxious. Yeah, when I watched The Social Network about Facebook, I don't know how accurate that is about Mark Zuckerberg, but you know, some of the rude, obnoxious things that he would say in a meeting, I would say, I spend most of my life trying not to say that to human beings. So, but if I were in a situation, I could imagine doing exactly that.
Right.
But you can't make yourself do that. So, I mean, the point is there. I'm just saying I'm an obnoxious something. Okay, sometimes I am. It's actually really funny. I've gotten really good when someone calls me and asks for money. I say, can you say whatever you're, like if they're trying to sell me some service, I say, can you describe what you offer me in one sentence without any jargon? Because if you can't, I'm going to hang up on you. And I hang up on people within a sentence now because I just don't have time.
Yeah.
So, which is a fun state to be in. Anyway, all that said, this whole thing of just kind of going, huh. Like, and it occurs to me the story, what really nailed it, it was actually funny. I had heard the story for the umpteenth time that, and this is such a part of the self-improvement and business self-improvement literature, that there was a study done of, let's just say, Princeton graduates from the class of 1953. I've heard it from Yale, I've heard it from Harvard, I've heard it different years. That 20 years later, they were investigated and found that the 3% that were the most successful were more successful than the other 97% combined. And the only thing that was different between them is that 3% had written down their goals. You've got to write down your goals. That's how important they are. And something snapped in my brain, and I went, that's not true. Just reeks of not true. And I got online, and I posted all over the place.
Yeah.
I'll give $1,000 to anyone who finds the study.
The actual study.
This. Yeah. After a few days, I posted, I'll give $1,000 to anyone who can prove to me that it didn't happen, even though it's hard to prove the absence of something.
Right.
20 minutes later, I got an email from the couple who started Snopes.com, the urban legend website, pointing me to a Fast Company article where someone had investigated this story and just tracked it, and found that there was no there there. So I emailed the Snopes people back and said, I got to be honest, you did that so quickly that I feel a little queasy about the idea of giving you $1,000. And they emailed back saying, we didn't expect you to give us anything. I said, great, here's $500. But that really nailed it. It's like that event was the turning point for me of let's stop listening to fantasies about reality and start paying attention to reality and see where that gets me.
Yeah.
And, you know, so far so good.
I love it. I mean, I struggle with it just like everyone else does, but it's the current, like what, everybody kind of believes is out there with no proof of, any of it. And I think that the entrepreneur, inventor, self-help books are probably the worst offenders, in so many ways because, sells a dream.
Now, that said, ironically, when people ask me, which you haven't yet, and I'm not suggesting you should have, but when people often ask me, what's the most important characteristic of an entrepreneur, I go, blind, optimistic naivete.
Yeah.
You got to walk in completely oblivious or willing to ignore what you know to be true, which is this is really hard work and it might not work.
Yeah.
And we had, we had some advisors early on who all met at Reebok 40 years ago, helped build that company to $1 billion+. And we met really accidentally. Really hit it off, and they're sitting around our kitchen table. I'm sorry, for the IRS purposes, conference room table. They're designing product with us and giving us a lot of advice. And they said, we would love to start this business with you, but we've been doing it for so long, we're not stupid enough to start another shoe company. And Lena and I said, we're deliberately remaining stupid.
Yeah, you have to. I think you're right.
Yeah, no question about it.
Otherwise, you've got all these handcuffs that...
Everyone says, if I had only known then what I know now, and luckily you don't.
Yeah.
And that's what allows you to jump in and do something silly, and sometimes you make a big difference. And sometimes
right.
It works, and sometimes it doesn't.
Well, that was great. Thank you so much for your time. It was so valuable. It was valuable to me. I wish I could take notes, otherwise I would be looking down like this the whole time now. But
the
I will
top of your head
these
looks fine.
I just want to kind of throw, and I have the green ones up here too, so that people remember after they watch this to go to zeroshoes.com or wherever you want them to go to pick up.
Zeroshoes.com, xeroshoes.com. That's a great place to go.
Yeah, they're fantastic. And I love what you've done. And what I think I really appreciate is the kind of uniqueness and kind of do it your own way perspective that you bring to it. I think it's really powerful and important for people to hear.
Oh, that's really fun.